Goeiemiddag. En baie welkom by hierdie gesprek. Theo het gister tydens die gesprek oor die verwonding van mans opgemerk dat hy dink, omdat daar gister so baie vrouens was by die manne gesprek, dat hy dink vandag gaan daar meerderheid mans wees. Die hoop het beskaam en ek wil welkom sê vir al die vrouens en dan een paar van die mans wat ook hier sit. So as jylle gesien het wat ons thema is, gaan het oor iets wat ons in Afrikaans baie goed ken, die woord, een woordspeling op die woord mannekrag. But to explain that to English people was a bit harder, because that just sounds like woman power. En het klink een bykie soos 'n 60s poster met die vrou wat sy face so in die lig is. But that said, het ek verlede week toe een voorafgesprek gehad met hierdie twee vrouens wat julle voor julle sien. En wat 'n voorreg om vir, ek weet hulle is nie op titels gesteld nie, en is die laaste keer wat ek het gaan sê, maar professor Denise Ackerman en Dr. Max Blackie hier te verwelkom. Tussen hulle is daar meer grade en ere doktersgrade en buitengewone professorskap as wat ek op my vinger kan noem. Maar hulle sit nie hier omdat hulle buitengewone professors of buitengewone akademici per se is nie. Hulle sit hier omdat hulle buitengewone mense is en in baie van ons lewens buitengewone denkers. Beide Mags en Denise se boeke het al, en ek het nou net buite ook gehoor, dat daar iemand is wat my standpunt hier oorsteen, het al 'n groot invloed gehad op baie van ons se lewens. Die vraag wat hulle vra, die konteks wat hulle gee binne Suid-Afrika, vanuit hulle verskillende velde, dien ons gemeenskap, en ek dink ook die breër Suid-Afrika, in a groot manier. So I just, as julle verskoon, ek gaan dalk baie keer die vraag vra in Afrikaans, maar dan moet julle julle Engelse ore aansit om dit in Engels aan te hoor. Because Denise, being always on the side of the other, just said she's going to speak in English, because Mags is now the minority here, to include Mags fully. So the moment when I got there at Denise's place and we were about to have this conversation, the first thing she asked me was, what on earth are me and Mags doing at the Woordfeest? Which immediately made me think about what I think, which is the effect she normally has on me, as does Mags. And the next question is, and what on earth does vulnerability have to do with feminism? What a paradox. So what a good question. Immediately. So I want to start off by asking you, and Mags, maybe starting with you, because you opened my eyes in a big way to see that most of the things we moan about, die goeders waaroor ons kla, ook as vrouens, are actually our choices. I chose to be a working mother. I chose to be this. I chose to be this. So what we are talking about here is not the inflicted vulnerability that Denise was immediately, I think, hearing in that statement. Because vulnerability is a huge thing for a lot of women in this country. Inflicted vulnerability. The question is more about chosen vulnerability. And do you think that vulnerability still has a place in theology, in feminist theology, in South Africa, for us as women?
Is this on? I think for me to speak to feminist theology itself is slightly dangerous. So I'll talk to faith. I think that vulnerability is essential in our faith. I think it really is. It's only in and through vulnerability that we can truly come to know who we are and truly come to know who God is. And any real connection is almost impossible without vulnerability. So I think it's profoundly risky, but it's the only thing that really gets us to where we need to be. I don't think there's another. It must be chosen, and it must be, we must enter into that space of vulnerability consciously and willingly. It can't be coerced, but it's the only thing there is. It's the only thing that gets us to be able to see what the right next step is, because it's the only way that we can come into real touch with who we are in ourselves and who we are in relation to others and who we are in relation to God.
Richard Rohr said, like, within the previous week, that we talk so easily of the Almighty God, but he thinks if we talk about the Trinity, and we're not going to talk about that now, the mystery of the Trinity, then we are actually supposed to say absolute vulnerability between three. Denise, how has the vulnerable God shaped your theology?
Thank you. I guess before I get there, I just need to say that the reactions that you saw in me are still there, because I believe, and my experience of many, many years has taught me, that in our society, culturally speaking, historically speaking, and in our religious institutions, there is definitely a role thrust on women, which I think is not in keeping with the teachings of my faith, certainly. And I think that role for women has been one of the things among it has been that you are the vulnerable ones. You need this, you need that. We'll look after you, cook the food, care for the kids, that sort of stuff. But I don't want to talk about that. Now, you know, when you said that word and I reacted, I thought I'd go and look in. I've got quite a large library of reference works on theology and spirituality, and see if in the index of any of them the word vulnerable appeared. They all ended either on violence or virgin. So I gave up. For me, vulnerability, in the sense that you wanting to steer me and ask me, has everything to do with relationship. I know where I'm most vulnerable. I'm most vulnerable with my children. I'm most vulnerable in my family. The closer the relationships, the greater the vulnerability. So how can it not be that in my relationship with my God, I'm not utterly vulnerable? And Mags and I share a common sort of tradition in terms of our spirituality. And I think it takes a long road to realize that in the eyes of God, in other words, standing before God, whatever that may mean, is being totally and utterly naked. No pretenses, none of that stuff that you were talking about when you introduced us. All of that is totally meaningless, because if I cannot be totally vulnerable with God, I shall never ever know how to trust God, even when the going is tough and things are not working out. I shall certainly not really understand something about the immensity of God's love. So I can't see it in any other way. But it's been a long journey to get there. And I agree with Mags. It does involve risk. It involves huge risk. But, you know, I think I said that to you too. I'm living in a community of old people now, like me. And when they hear of my profession, they say to me, "Oh, you believe in God?" And I say, "No, I don't believe in God." And then they look shocked. And then I say, "I trust in God." So the vulnerability has taught me something about that trust, particularly, yeah, when the proverbial pawpaw hits the fan. Because that's what I need in order to help me to get through.
Do you think when you arrived in Stellenbosch in 1951, is my date correct?
Yep.
Okay. With a jean on from Buenos Aires, is my country correct? I've heard you were the first woman to wear a jean on this campus.
That's true.
I've also heard that... because jeans weren't available in South Africa at this time. I've also heard that you led the first women's march on this campus because of a worm in your food. And with that said, dan was al seker worms in almal se kos, so sy het dit nie net gedoen vir haarself nie. Because our question is about vulnerability and how does vulnerability aid activism? So do you think that also, like from your weerstand against what you saw in this country, did it also come from a vulnerable place?
Right. Ek kon net sê ek was in huisdif en my huismoeder het elke jaar die prys gewen omdat sy op die goedkoopste budget uitgekom het. So the food was terrible. You know, I think it brought me face to face with my vulnerability because I do remember going to a meeting. When I left university, I actually worked for Rembrandt for a while. They had their offices down in Bird Street. And I went to a meeting at this building next door at the City Hall. And I remember at that meeting, Saint-Peter Blanche was there. And they were talking about removing the colored people from the voters' roll. It was in 1955, 56. And I listened to all the arguments. I didn't understand much about it, but it just seemed to me to be wrong. And when it got to question time, I sort of stood up very huiverig and I said, "That's unfair." And I was yelled down. And that night, I lived in Nassauhuis, and that night somebody threw a brick through my window. And that to me was the first intimation in my life, which I suppose in many respects had been quite protected, of vulnerability. If you rise above or if you are different to the ordinary norms. And so yes, but I mean when in the old bad days when one went into a township, you were immediately vulnerable. I slept in a township and the house next door to me was bombed. So I knew fear, and I mean that's also a kind of vulnerability. So I don't think being vulnerable put me off as much as it made me experience something of a reality that I had to learn about. It was a reality in my face.
So, beide van hulle staan in 'n professie. Ek sê staan in 'n professie, want eintlik is jy nog steeds in jou professie. Wat maar hoofsaaklik 'n manlik gedomineer is. Max is in die laboratorium, medisinale chemie is haar veld, sowel as wetenskaplike opvoeding. Denise was die eerste, en ek weet dit maak nie saak nie, ek wil dit net sê om 'n punt te bewys, sy was die eerste vroulike professor in teologie in hierdie land. Hoe het hoe was dit aan die begin van julle loopbane? 8241, baie goeie vriende, hulle deel baie. Hoe was dit aan die begin van julle loopbane? En how was it at the beginning of your careers, being in a male-dominated environment? And how has things changed in South Africa, at least?
So the beginning of my career really wasn't that long ago. but I think for me, it never really occurred to me that I was entering a male-dominated field when I began. It was the thing I was interested in, so it was the thing I pursued. And it never really impacted what I was doing as a grad student. I got on and did my work, and my reactions worked. Like, I did my work. I got my PhD. What I've noticed, as time has gone on, I've noticed more and more the differences in gender. I think, not that it's a bad thing, it's just women and men navigate their academic careers slightly differently, and the system is definitely set up a little bit, not surprisingly, because of the historical dominance of men within the field. It's set up very much in a way that favors the way that men work a little bit more than the way women work. For example, I said in our conversation the other day that it's really become quite obvious to me that women tend to work significantly more collaboratively. They also tend to be slightly less singularly focused. And that the system is set up to, in fact, penalize you for that. Now, you can choose... I could choose to shift my focus, but I don't want to do that. I'd rather take a little bit longer to get where I need to go, because the more of us who do that, eventually the system will change.
Denise?
You know, thinking back, because you're making me think back, the interesting thing is for me, I mean, I was solitary woman in faculties wherever I was teaching for a long, long time. Interestingly enough, by and large, I had very little problems with my male colleagues. I found more, of course, there was resistance in my church. There was resistance among women's groups where I was involved. Because the whole idea of claiming your identity as a woman, and whatever that meant, was only then starting to come in. I was delighted when I finally had a female colleague, a very dear one, who's still here at the university. But I was quite surprised how women resisted the idea. For instance, I wrote my master's thesis on the whole question of the gifts of the spirit and why women should not be as gifted as men are, and also for ministry. Because at that stage, in not a single one of our churches around here, except I think the Congregational Church, were women being ordained. I did not want to be ordained, and I never have been, probably because I can't swear obedience to any bishop I know. But I don't think so. I don't think I've had the call to that. My call has been to do what I do in the academic world. I was very interested to see that when I started to speak up, the kind of reactions I got from women, that some felt it was quite threatening, because it rocks a comfort zone when you've assumed a role and you've been in that role for so long, you don't want the boat rocked. However, there are new generations of women now, and there's Mags, it's wonderful. She doesn't even spend a lot of time thinking about gender, she just gets on with it. And that's how it should be. We shouldn't be so fixated on it. But may I just say one thing quickly? I also realized in the early days when I was writing and thinking about gender discrimination, that discrimination works in all spheres. That the way in which gender discrimination works is fundamentally not greatly different from racism, from a bias against gay people, from bias against people with disabilities or whatever it is. And I realized that it's, the mechanisms are really much the same. And so it's something that we all have to resist because we can, surely we can all claim our humanity with the uniqueness that each one of us has.
I during this week after I was at your place, I had a thought, and weirdly enough, after that conversation, I was thinking about my thoughts the whole time because I cannot just assume anything anymore from that day on. I was thinking, ek het lanklaas 'n man ontmoet wat my in my broek laat bewe. And then I was at your place. And then I met two women who makes me actually bewe in my broek. But actually, but that statement, that thought, and I also, I'm like Mags, I don't think about this stuff anymore. I was never penalized in anything I did. But that thought also comes from something within our patriarchal system that has filtered through to us. Hoekom moet ek bewe in my broek vir 'n man? Hoekom is dit my gedagtes en nie vir 'n vrou nie? Like, to be scared of male dominance or a male figure. Het my laat dink dat daar nog baie daarvan selfs in ons is, even in our generation, although we don't have to think about it a lot anymore. I want to ask you, you talked about the vulnerability motherhood creates. Not motherhood as a role, but to have children. I think it's Jacob Zuma that said the other day that, I'm going to gooi a wisdom now, that said that women should get children to be able to learn to be mothers. So we are over apartheid now and the power that came along with that. Now, to say something like that to you, Mags, not being a mother, what does that provoke? Ek weet ek kan nie vir Denise aan die gang kry oor Zuma nie, sy sal vir ons hier lank besig hou.
Well, I think to some extent, I think there is some truth in the fact that I have sisters who have children. We talk a lot about what it is to have children. And I certainly know with my sisters that being the experience of motherhood has extracted something quite new from them. That I'm not sure they would have opened that part of themselves in any other way. So I think that's absolutely true in that sense. I think that there's a lot more to what it is to be a human being that isn't necessarily, I'm not sure that my fulfillment as a woman is linked to whether I have children or not. I hope it's not, because otherwise I'm in trouble. The probability of me having children is very slim. So I'm going to, if the statement is about the link between the fulfillment of a woman must be through motherhood, I have a very big problem with that.
But I think motherhood really does. It is profound. And that shouldn't be minimized.
Do you want to say something about that?
I just think what my kids would say if they saw me sitting here. I just think it's the hardest thing I've ever tried to do. Anybody who's raised children and tried to combine it with a career, that's not easy. Anybody who's raised people who've grown up through their teen years needs hair on their teeth. And now I'm in the position to watch my children rearing their children and having to hold my tongue and also at the same time enjoying immensely being a grandmother. But I did not know that I would become so vulnerable with grandchildren. When I watch them and when I see, I have one in particular who has a great deal of pain, and what that does to me. So the vulnerability for me just goes on through this whole mothering, grandmothering thing. Whether it changed me or not, I have no idea what I would have been like if I hadn't had children. Perhaps I also have the interesting thing, I have one adopted child. And that's a different challenge to my biological children. So maybe for somebody like me, I just had to learn some hard stuff. And I don't think, and I think Mags would agree with me, I mean, these things are not coincidence. I chose to adopt a child, but you know, you don't... There is absolutely no guarantee for anything when you're raising children. You can be the most loving, most caring person in the world. And I've seen it happen to people who it shouldn't happen to. Lots of pain from their children. Yeah, so I just think for me, it was just jeepers in the days when I got married. You mean you got married and had kids? And if you didn't have them, well, there was something wrong with you. And you have much greater freedom today for women to have choices, which I also think is important. I'm not defined through my motherhood. It's a part of me, but it's not the definition of who Denise is.
Denise, can you tell us, because most of us learned about that in our history books only, if we were raised in the 80s and 90s, can you tell us a bit about the movement, the Black Sash, which Nelson Mandela referred to as the conscience, the white conscience of apartheid back then, and being part of that?
Well, the Sash started in the late 60s, as far as I can remember. So it was around for a long time, and it started as a white middle-class women's movement in protest against the removal of the colored people from the voters' roll. And when that was a battle that was lost, everybody thought, well, now they would dissolve. It had about 10, 15,000 members then. But no, a core group continued. And they continued to do what they said, to mourn for the breaking of the Constitution. And boy, shouldn't we be doing that today? And the Black Sash came from the idea of mourning. And so they used to haunt ministers whenever they arrived on trains and things and just stand there with their eyes downcast with a black sash on. And when they went to Parliament with black sashes and they were thrown out, they went and bought black gloves and they sat there like this. And for me, it was, well, let me just take one step back. Are you hearing me? I'm never sure where to hold this thing. I decided to fight my battles against white racism through church organizations and affiliated faith organizations, the Institute for Contextual Theology, the South African Council of Churches, and I was a friend of Beyers Naudé, and I was part of the Beyers Naudé setup. But the Black Sash is not that. The Black Sash is a secular organization. But what interested me was how many of the women, when I started to do, I was a member and I did all the things that they do. But then when I wrote about them, I found out just how many of them were actually people who had faith, whether they were Jewish women or Christian women. And later on, there were women of other denominations as well, I mean, of other religions as well. And the Sheena Duncan, who was a sort of tower of it all, is a devoted Christian. But they did not do it out of religious conviction. They had a deep sense of justice. And of course, in 94, the protest part of the Black Sash stopped. A lot of the funding from overseas stopped. But they still remained a core group of people, and they still run the advice offices which give the poor help on getting their pensions. This whole SASSA debacle, they're involved in it. As you know, they're going to court on it. So it's still a justice-driven organization.
I want to ask you, and maybe that will be the second last question for me. I think it's Brené Brown who said that faith minus vulnerability will always become extremism. That somehow, if we think we deal with certainty and all reason and rationality when it comes to God and to most of us then regarding the Bible, then it will become fundamentalism or extremism. Obviously, we see that in current world affairs. I want to hear your view on that. But also, as not only as women, but as human beings, from a point of not being certain, what are we to do in this country and in the wider globe? It may be a very wide question and maybe a very narrow question. I don't know. I just want to hear you say something that makes me bitter in my brook again.
So I'll leap in and Denise can correct me. I think, you know, I've actually been thinking about this question quite a lot. You know, what is my response to the politics of fear, which is so dominant in so many places? And I think, coincidentally with that, I for many, many years considered myself quite a loner. I'm a profound introvert, very happy in my own company. And I think really that shifting in me to recognize the importance of communities of faith. And I don't mean necessarily churches, although it may be, of small communities of people with whom we can try to live a life of discernment and to whom I am accountable. What impact is that going to have? I have absolutely no idea, but it's all I've got. And I think I'm going to trust that. I'm going to trust that until something else, I'm going to keep asking and keep looking, but until something else emerges that seems to be a better idea, for me right now, this is my response.
As you rightly say, fundamentalism functions on certainty. I have the truth. Of course, we know that it can quickly flip over into intolerance. What characterizes fundamentalism is that it is firstly anti-intellectual in many ways. It's unthinking. And I also think, and whether it's in Islam or in Judaism or in Christianity, religious fundamentalism is an extraordinarily dangerous tool in the hands of people who want to use power. And I think we're seeing it today. And I think I don't need to talk about it. You all, like me, watch the horrors on our television sets. For me, it is the inability to do two things. Firstly, to let go of certainty, to live with the questions, to know that we do not have answers to everything. I mean, it is just so, almost at times, beyond my ability to understand. When I listen to the way in which some people use scripture, for instance, to bolster their beliefs. Sua sedi scrif, this is what the Bible says, so that must be so. Or the way in which people use doctrine, or whatever it is, I'm talking about in religious communities. So firstly, I think it is a lack of the ability to be vulnerable, because if you don't know, and if you say, I don't know, you are vulnerable. Secondly, how on earth can we assume that we know everything there is to know about God? God is the unknowable knowable. We know a bit about God. We know what we know through our faith and through our relationship, through our experience, through Jesus Christ, if we're Christians. But we can never, ever forget that God is still the unknowable being. So God is mystery. And if we can't embrace mystery, I don't know, then we land up, I think, in very dangerous places. Then we have to drive the engine is I know. And that ultimately is making God in our image. I can't tell you how many man-made gods I've met in my life. And I'm tired of it.
Thank you for advocating freedom to us and making us believe that true power lies in that. En soos Marty gesê het, mag ons dit gaan wees. Baie dankie.
Thank you.